Surfacing, written by Margaret Atwood and read by Kim Handysides.
Part 1, Chapter 1. I can't believe I'm on this road again, twisting along past the lake where the white birches are dying. The disease is spreading up from the south, and I notice they now have seaplanes for hire. But this is still near the city limits. We didn't go through. It's swelled enough to have a bypass. That's success. I never thought of it as a city, but as the last or first outpost, depending on which way we were going. An accumulation of sheds and boxes and one main street with a movie theater, the It's, the Oil, Red R Burnt Out, and two restaurants which served identical gray hamburger steaks plastered with mud gravy and canned peas, watery and pallid as fish eyes, and French fries bleary with lard. "Order a poached egg," my mother said. "You can tell if it's fresh by the edges." In one of those restaurants, before I was born, my brother got under the table and slid his hands up and down the waitress's legs while she was bringing the food. It was during the war, and she had on shiny orange rayon stockings. He'd never seen them before. My mother didn't wear them. A different year there, we ran through the snow across the sidewalk in our bare feet because we had no shoes. They'd worn out during the summer. In the car, that time, we sat with our feet wrapped in blankets, pretending we were wounded. My brother said the Germans shot our feet off. Now, though, I'm in another car, David's and Anna's. It's sharp-finned and striped with chrome. A lumbering monster left over from 10 years ago. He has to reach under the instrument panel to turn on the lights. David says they can't afford a newer one, which probably isn't true. He's a good driver. I realize that. I keep my outside hand on the door in spite of it, to brace myself and so I can get out quickly if I have to. I've driven in the same car with them before, but on this road, it doesn't seem right. Either the three of them are in the wrong place, or I am. I'm in the back seat with the pack sacks. This one, Joe, is sitting beside me chewing gum and holding my hand. They both pass the time. I examine the hand. The palm is broad. The short fingers tighten and relax, fiddling with my gold ring, turning it. It's a reflex of his. He has peasant hands. I have peasant feet. Anna told us that. Everyone now can do a little magic. She reads hands at parties. She says it's a substitute for conversation. When she did mine, she said, "Do you have a twin?" I said no. "Are you positive?" she said. "Because some of your lines are double." Her index finger traced me. "You had a good childhood, but then there's this funny break." She puckered her forehead, and I said I just wanted to know how long I was going to live. She could skip the rest. After that, she told us Joe's hands were dependable but not sensitive, and I laughed, which was a mistake. From the side, he's like the buffalo on the U.S. nickel, shaggy and blunt-snouted, with small clenched eyes and the defiant but insane look of a species once dominant, now threatened with extinction. That's how he thinks of himself, too. Deposed, unjustly. Secretly, he would like them to set up a kind of park for him, like a bird sanctuary. Beautiful Joe. He feels me watching him and lets go of my hand. Then he takes his gum out, bundling it in the silver wrapper and sticks it in the ashtray and crosses his arms. That means I'm not supposed to observe him. I face front. In the first few hours of driving, we moved through flattened, cow-sprinkled hills and leaf trees and dead elm skeletons, then into the needle trees and the cuttings, dynamited in pink and gray granite, and the flimsy tourist cabins, and the sign saying, "Gateway to the North." At least four towns claim to be that.